South Central Los Angeles, 1984. For years, the area has been besieged by escalating violent crime. Rapes, murders, police brutality, and gang warfare are just a part of the daily life for those who call the area home. In recent years, however, both the police and the public at large have noticed an escalation to the violence. Coincided with the introduction of a new drug on the streets, crack cocaine. What was once known as dangerous neighborhoods has now grown into open war zones. As the year passes, however, police begin to notice a pattern among many of these killings. Young women known to have drug problems and to walk the streets are found murdered, cast aside in abandoned lots and on sidewalks. Police begin to suspect that a serial killer is stalking the streets of South Central, targeting the drug addicts who sell their bodies to get their fix. And while some men will eventually be arrested for these so-called strawberry murders, one will continue to elude law enforcement for many years. That man will become known as the Grim Sleeper. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take a look at a case that for me is extremely fascinating. That is the tale of Lonnie Franklin Jr., also known by the nom de plume as the Grim Sleeper. Before we get diving into that, however, a couple of show notes. First off, I would like to again thank my guest from our special episode last week, Bill Kinnison. I had a lot of fun talking with him, and the feedback I have received on that episode has been some of the most positive that I've gotten yet. If you would like to help out the show, you can find me on most every podcast platform. Just search for The Deathcast. Like, subscribe, share it on social media, leave a 5-star review. Those really do help the show grow. If you would like to follow me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, MeWe, and YouTube, just search for Ian Tott, an author. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, just search for Corpse Creek Publishing. Don't forget to check out my official website, CorpseCreekPublishing.com. There you can sign up for the mailing list and make a donation if you'd like to help with the production of this show or just want to say thanks, buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of cigarettes. If you'd like to find any of my novels, that would be the Blood Gods Trilogy, The House of Silver Doors, or The Throwaway Girls of Olympia. They can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or you can go to your local bookstore and ask them to order you a copy. I know my website lists them as being for sale, but I have not yet had a chance to get up the capital to pay what GoDaddy wants to have a storefront on my page, but that will be coming soon, at which point you will be able to get autographed copies. Alright, so now that is all out of the way, get yourself something to drink, sit back, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. As you heard in the trailer for this week's show, we're going to be covering the case of the man who was dubbed by the media as the Grim Sleeper. And he got this moniker because he was known to have killed in the mid to late 80s before taking a break of over a decade. And he fits into kind of a very unique period of time in South Central Los Angeles, where you had at least 5 or 6 different serial killers active in the same geographic area, hunting the same type of prey. That would be mostly young African-American women known to have drug problems and also to be working as prostitutes. When a lot of people think of South Central Los Angeles, they think of movies like Boys in the Hood or Gangsta Rap. And this story really starts slightly before all of that started really, you know, coming out into American pop culture. The first known killings by the Grim Sleeper took place in 1985. But prior to that, you'd had a lot of street gang activity in the area with disenfranchised youths, you know, ganging up together in order to A, protect themselves, and B, make money. This is groups like the Crips and the Bloods and the various subsets of those organizations. So to say that the area was fairly unsafe, I don't think would be a stretch of the imagination. Then, in the early 1980s, you had the introduction of crack cocaine into the area. Some people say that it was a CIA plot. I don't know if I believe that or not, but regardless, when crack hit the streets of South Central, it had a devastating effect on the communities. And crimes, particularly violent crime, really began to skyrocket. As drug dealers and gang members began to fight one another over turf, and young women who had become addicted to this new drug began to walk the streets in droves in order to feed their habit. And as you've seen with some of the other cases I've covered, any time where there are vulnerable women present who are selling their bodies, predators seem to get drawn to those areas like moths to a flame. Police really started noticing that something was going on in the streets somewhere in 1984 when they began to find the bodies of young women really just tossed out like trash. Some of them had been shot, others strangled or stabbed. All of them had some things in common, however. They were drug addicts. They were mostly, you know, young African Americans, and they were working as prostitutes. Now, despite these discrepancies in the modus operandi as far as how these women were killed, the police initially thought that it was the work of a single perpetrator. And that's really important to note, as is the fact that despite the image that LA likes to put out of being, you know, this all-inclusive city, there is rampant racism within the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. That's the organization that oversees, you know, policing in LA. This is not a political statement or anything like that. It's just fact, and it can be backed up with fact, in that starting in at least the mid to late 1970s, sheriff's deputy gangs were known to be active in many of the stations throughout the area. And these sheriff's deputy gangs would, you know, go around and really just bully the people who they were ostensibly paid to protect. This bullying included planting evidence on individuals who wouldn't do the things that they wanted them to do. In a couple of cases, there were killings, beatings, targeting of specific individuals or groups. But there was more to it than just that. The police who worked in that area really didn't want to or care about taking care of the air that they were working in. Part of that has to do with the fact that most of the citizens who lived in South Central were distrustful of police, and that distrust and dislike went both ways. Because of these factors, as well as the fact that Richard Ramirez had just been arrested not very long beforehand and was in all of the local and national media, these slangs that were taking place currently in South Central kind of went under the radar for the most part. Some people knew about it, but there was not a lot of talk concerning it, as, again, Ramirez was, you know, the name that was on everybody's lips. As 1985 rolled around, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department set up a task force to look into the so-called Southside slang crimes. Eventually, it would come out that the crimes were committed by numerous different individuals. And once the police realized that was the case, now their task was that much greater, as how do you decide which ones are the work of Killer A and which ones are the work of Killer C? Because again, there were different modus operandi in play. One of the individuals was known to use a 9mm handgun to dispatch their victims, and eventually a police officer would be arrested for one of these series of crimes after he was discovered to have a prostitute in the car with him, and an old 9mm was found inside the trunk of the vehicle. Eventually, this guy would be convicted of the crimes, only to have it overturned when it was found that the bullets did not come from the gun that he had. But you can kind of see how the police had cast a very wide net and were just trying to, you know, arrest anybody that they could. On September 23rd, 1985, the police announced to the public that there was a serial killer. But again, at the time, they did not know there were numerous individuals who were committing these crimes. We're going to back up a little bit into August of 1985. That's August 10th, when a 29-year-old woman named Deborah Jackson was found. There's conflicting reports as to where her body was actually found, if it was in a dumpster, on a sidewalk, on somebody's lawn, or in a vacant lot. But the police did note that there was a difference in this particular case, as Deborah was shot with a .25 caliber handgun. The following month, when the police officially announced that there was a serial killer active in South Central, there was a lot of public outcry from the citizens who felt that the police had known about this for at least, you know, 7 or 8 months, yet had not taken the steps to inform the public of the danger that was lurking among them. And I think that's a honest criticism of the police, and it plays into what I've already discussed as far as the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and how they viewed those that they were hired to serve. You look back at other cases, most notably the Green River case, which I covered 2 weeks ago in a 5-part series. The police in Seattle were really upfront with the populace about what was going on and the fact that there was a serial killer in their midst. Not so in Los Angeles. some similarities between the Green River killings and those of the Grim Sleeper. The prostitutes in Seattle along the SeaTac Highway were very reluctant to speak with police officers, as were these young women who were working the streets of South Central. However, big difference here was that not only were the, potential victims unwilling to talk with police, the populace as a whole were unwilling to talk to police. And I am almost certain that that played a large part in how the LAPD handled the situation. I'm sure they had a mindset of, well, if these people aren't going to help us help them, then we're not going to really do much about it. The next known victim was found a year and 2 days later in the Hyde Park area of Los Angeles. This was 34-year-old Henrietta Wright. She, too, had been shot with a .25 caliber handgun. And as with the previous victim, police noted that her shirt and bra had been pushed up and her body dumped out where anyone could find it. So we have a cooling period of at least a year in between these two murders, which, as I've seen with other killers, is not that uncommon, especially when they are first starting out in their killings. It's known that killers of this type take a sexual gratification from the, acts of rape that they perpetrate on their victims, as well as the ultimate show of power and authority, which is the taking of their life. And for many of these individuals, it's not uncommon that they will have a cooling off period, although a year in between killings does seem rather long. And it makes me wonder if there were not other victims that have not been either identified or found who the Grim Sleeper took care of. As for the LAPD, the killings, so far as they could tell, never stopped. It was just that the victims, although sharing similarities as far as lifestyles, etc., were being murdered in different manners. So they were still operating under this assumption that a single person was responsible for it. 2 days after Henrietta Wright was murdered, another victim was found. This time it was a male by the name of Thomas Sylvester Steele, who was 36 years old. This is a case that was never able to be, definitively linked to Lonnie Franklin. However, police suspect that he was a victim of his. They further suspect that either Steele found out that Franklin was killing women and became collateral damage, or he had known one of the victims and began asking around about them and just happened to ask the wrong person. On January 10th of 1987, 23-year-old Barbara Ware was found shot with a .25 caliber bullet. Again, as with the previous victims, her shirt had been pushed up, her breast had been exposed. A few short months after this, on May 29th, 1987, a man by the name of Lewis Crane was arrested after the rape, sodomy, and strangulation murder of a 29-year-old woman named Carolyn Barney. Police believed at the time that Crane was, in fact, the Southside Slayer, and even said as much in the news media. And the way that the police caught Crane was, the body was found in an abandoned house, not far from where her parents and Crane's brother lived. They noticed Crane in the standing in the area, acting oddly and watching what the police were doing. Apparently, Crane's arrest was somewhat controversial. It was said that he had diminished mental capacities, and he went on to say that his brother was the man who had actually committed this murder, which was found not to be true, as his brother Roger had an alibi for the time of the killing. Crane would eventually be sentenced for this crime, as well as two other murders, and he would die in prison in 1989 from complications from AIDS. At the time of his arrest, though, the police were really up on the fact that, hey, we got our guy. And I can see why they did this, because there was a lot of pressure on them from a lot of activist groups that were active in South Central at the time. This really started kicking into high gear around March, April of 87, especially after the body of a 26-year-old woman named Bernita Sparks was found, she too having been shot with a 25 caliber gun. So you can see it's only a couple weeks after this murder that another one takes place and Crane is arrested. You can also see, though, that Franklin was stepping up his game, so to speak. The cool-off times in between his murders had, you know, were shrinking from that year-long period down to a span of just a few months. In fact, on November 1st of 1987, a 26-year-old woman by the name of Mary Lowe was found in the Gramercy Park area of Los Angeles, the same area the Bernita Sparks body had been found. She, too, had been raped, shot, and molested by her killer. And you'll see this on certain sites, particularly, I believe it's the Criminal Minds wiki. They state that Franklin was dubbed the Grim Sleeper at this point. That is not true. That did not actually happen until the 2000s. At this point, the police realized that there was another killer who was active, and these particular crimes were dubbed the Strawberry Murders, as Strawberry is a slang term for a woman who sells her body on the streets. While the police had no suspects for any of these killings at this point, they had one bit of evidence that would later come back to help convict Franklin, and that was DNA evidence. See, Franklin had this habit of pulling up the shirts and the bra and putting his mouth on the victim's breasts. Whether this was before or after he murdered him, I am not certain. But in doing so, he left saliva on them, and police were able to recover this from the victim's bodies. They also had witnesses who saw a few of the bodies being dumped, and all of them gave a similar description of a small yellow or orange Ford Pinto. And I've read various accounts that Franklin, because of this car, had a few run-ins with police over the years, although most of these seem to be dubious at best. But the police did have this information. On January 30th, 1988, the body of 22-year-old Lucretia Denise Jefferson was found in the Westmont neighborhood of Los Angeles. She, too, had been killed and defiled in a similar manner. keep in mind as I'm going over these known victims that just because these ones have been either presumed to be linked to Franklin or definitively linked to him, there were other murders of young women, not all of them prostitutes, going on in South Central Los Angeles. And while a number of them have been solved with the arrest of other serial killers, not all of them have been. And Lonnie Franklin was one of those rare killers who actually did change up his modus operandi in that he would eventually move from using a gun to strangulation. So it's very possible that he did commit murders that the police never got him for, and that he simply strangled the victims as opposed to having shot them. On August 15th, 1988, a 28-year-old woman named Inez Warren was found in Gramercy Park area of Los Angeles. She, too, had been murdered in a similar manner as the known victims of Lonnie Franklin, and she is now considered a possible victim of the Grim Sleeper. On September 11th, 1988, in the Vermont Square area of L.A., 18-year-old Alicia Alexander was found dead. On November 20th, 1988, an Arita Marguerite Washington, age 30, was attacked in the Gramercy Park area of L.A. Now, this is probably the most important assault in this entire case because Miss Washington actually survived her assault. And in fact, if you go and search out the film Tales of the Grim Sleeper by Nick Broomfield, you can actually hear her recounting what happened that evening. But I'm going to go over it briefly here. Basically, she was out with a friend. They're planning to go out for the night. And a guy approached her, and she described him as something of a player and started pestering her to let him give her a ride to where she was heading. And she didn't, you know, something about the guy seemed off. And he kept pestering her, kept pestering her, kept pestering her. And eventually she agreed to go with him, and they got into an orange Ford Pinto and began driving. The driver was talking to her, and according to her, it was as though a switch had been flipped inside of the man. And he went from being this, you know, kind of annoying, jovial individual to something else entirely. He turned mean. And at this point, he either struck her or simply pulled out the gun and shot her in the chest. She blacks out because of this, and when she comes to, the man is on top of her, his mouth is on her chest, he's pushed her shirt and bra up, and he's continuing to assault her. Eventually, he ends up shoving her body out of the car and leaving her for dead on a sidewalk, but Anita is not dead. In fact, over a period of time, as she's swimming in and out of consciousness, she ends up dragging herself to someone's home, who eventually calls the police. They're able to get DNA from her and amazingly save her life. She's also able to give a description of the man who attacked her as well as his vehicle. And the reason I say this is probably the most important attack, you know, of everything that Lonnie Franklin did is that years later she would be able to give testimony at his trial. after this attack, the killer pretty much goes into hibernation, at least as far as the police and anyone else knows. And again, as I talked about earlier, a number of other individuals would be captured and convicted for some of the murders that happened during this Southside Slaying period. But the man who was responsible for the so-called Strawberry murders was still out there, and the police knew this. In fact, the lone survivor, upon seeing the other men who were arrested and convicted, stated that that wasn't the man who had assaulted her. So the police kept looking as the 80s rolled over into the 90s, and the 90s eventually rolled over into the 2000s. On December 28th, 2000, Georgia Mae Thomas, age 43, was found strangled in a park in Southside Los Angeles. As with the other victims, her shirt had been pushed up and her breasts had been assaulted. Now, initially, the police did not realize that their killer had returned. A little less than a year and a half later, 15-year-old Princess Cheyenne, I can't even pronounce that last name, so I'll just spell it for you, Berthomieux, was found strangled in the Inglewood neighborhood. Over a year later, 35-year-old Valerie Louise McCorvey was found in the Westmont neighborhood. She too had been strangled. In February of 2005, an 18-year-old by the name of Ayella Marshall was last seen. This is one of those victims who is suspected to have fallen prey to Lonnie Franklin, although her body has never been found. The reason that she is suspected as being a victim of the Grim Sleeper is that her school ID card was found in his possession after arrest. On September 5th of 2005, 31-year-old Rolina Morris was last seen. As with the previous victim, her body has never been found, although sexually explicit photographs as well as her driver's license were found in Franklin's possession. On January 1st, 2007, Janicia Lavette Peters, age 25, was found in the Gramercy Park neighborhood. As with the victims from the 1980s, she was shot in the chest with a 25 caliber handgun. She was also strangled in addition to being sexually assaulted. Now, in May of 2007, the LAPD linked the death of Janicia Peters through DNA analysis with at least 11 other murders in Los Angeles. Also during that year, something called the 800 Task Force was formed to look into these older murders as well as the more recent ones. And eventually, a reporter by the name of Christine Pilesic broke the story for LA Weekly. And it was in this article that she wrote that the term Grim Sleeper was coined. She also went on to recount how the top brass in the government inside of LA were not willing to speak about the case, and although they knew what was going on, refused to comment publicly concerning it. You will see different things stating that the mayor of Los Angeles, in fact, coined the term Grim Sleeper. That's absolute bullshit. I have read the articles from LA Weekly, and the term and moniker of Grim Sleeper is specifically in there. It wasn't, however, until 2008 when the city of Los Angeles officially adopted the term for the killer, at which point they offered a $500,000 reward to anyone who helped with the capture of the individual. At this press conference where the reward was offered, a 911 call from the 1980s was released where a man reported seeing a body being dumped and giving a detailed description and license plate number, which was connected with a church which has since closed, known as the Cosmopolitan Church. Unfortunately, however, at that period in time, the police were not able to link that van with Franklin. In March of 2009, Christina Polisky did an interview with Anarita Washington, who, if you'll remember, was the sole survivor of the Strawberry murders. She described the man who attacked her as in his early 30s. He was neat and tidy, kind of geeky, wore a black polo shirt tucked into khaki trousers. She also gave a very detailed description of both the interior and exterior of the man's vehicle. The way the Grim Sleeper was caught is one of those things that has stirred a little bit of controversy, as they had DNA from the crimes in the 1980s and the 2000s, and they used this DNA through a genealogy website to track down possible relatives of the killer. And one of the individuals that they came across while doing this DNA search was a young man by the name of Christopher Franklin. They found that the DNA that they had meant that this young man was more probably than not the son, or at least a very close relative, of the killer. The way they did this was the DNA led back to another relative of the Franklin family, and because Christopher was a convicted felon, the state of California had his DNA on file. So the police began looking around at his father, a man by the name of Lonnie Franklin Jr. They knew he was their man, but they needed conclusive evidence in the form of DNA to link him to the crimes that they knew he committed. So what they did was they sent police officers in to work at a birthday party at a local pizza place where Franklin was at. They took a plate that Franklin had been eating off of from the party. Mind you, they're dressed as waiters and servers in this restaurant so as not to, you know, raise any suspicion. And the officer took the plate straight out of the restaurant, brought it to the surveillance team who were inside of a van, and it was rushed off for testing. Through this testing, they were able to conclusively link Lonnie Franklin to the murders. And on July 7th of 2010, he was arrested at his home. So before we go into the rest of this case, let's look at Lonnie David Franklin Jr. He was born August 30th, 1952. In Los Angeles, there really isn't much known about his early life. It is known that in the 1970s, he joined the United States Army, and he was stationed in Stuttgart, Germany as an auto mechanic. In April of 1974, he and a group of other soldiers were arrested and convicted after gang raping a 17-year-old local girl. Apparently, he and the other two men were driving around and saw the young woman. They pulled over to ask directions before offering her a ride home, at which time they produced a knife and put it to her throat before driving her to a field where she was repeatedly raped. At one point during the assault, the young woman feigned interest in Franklin and asked for his phone number, and this was how the police were able to identify, arrest, and convict him for it. Of note concerning this assault, photographs were taken during it, and that's notable because, as you're going to see, Franklin took a lot of photographs of women. In July of 1975, he was discharged from the army, stemming from this rape conviction. Some sources have it that he was dishonorably discharged, others that he was given a general discharge. Either way, it meant that he was ineligible for any of the benefits that one would receive for being a veteran of the United States military. After coming back to Los Angeles, Franklin married and had two children, a son named Christopher and I believe a daughter. He ended up having various jobs throughout the years, at one point working for the Los Angeles Sanitation Department and then briefly as a mechanic for the LAPD in their motor pool where he fixed their vehicles. I say briefly because it's really hard to find an actual timeline on his employment status. Some things state that he worked for a number of years for the LAPD, whereas most official documentation from Los Angeles states it was only for a year or two, and I suspect this might be more likely than not them covering their ass. At any rate, he worked these jobs. He was also known around his neighborhood as a individual who would help out his neighbors, fixing their vehicles for free or at low cost. He was also somebody who was known to, and just as generally, an all-around likable guy. But there were people in the neighborhood who knew that Franklin was not this wholesome family man that he liked to put himself out to be. Again, referencing Tales of the Grim Sleeper by Nick Broomfield, when the director first meets some of Franklin's friends and neighbors, they all act, extremely shocked over the fact that he had been arrested. But not long after that, he is contacted by two of these men who want to talk to him further. And you can tell from watching them that they are really disturbed and that they know more than they let on in their first interviews. And when I say they know more, I'm not saying they knew he was committing murders, but it comes apparent after listening to these men talk that Franklin was fairly promiscuous. He enjoyed having sex with multiple partners and taking pictures of these partners. Oftentimes in these pictures, the women appeared to be either unconscious or dead. One of his friends went on to recount how Lonnie would show off the 25 caliber handgun that he had, and also how at one point he had seen a pair of handcuffs fall out of the back of Lonnie's car, which Lonnie played it off, and they joked about them. And it seems that, you know, among Lonnie and his friends, they would trade pictures of their various conquests back and forth. Lonnie did a lot of his, you know, extramarital activities either in a van that he owned or later in a mobile home that he had. One of his friends is on the record as stating that he had cleaned up what he thought was oil from the carpet a number of times during the period that Lonnie owned this mobile home, which was eventually confiscated by the police. Also confiscated by the police were shoebox filled with pictures of various women. So there were other pictures found, however, as the police searched through his garage. One of the stories that I've heard about this, the most prevalent, is that police poked a hole inside a piece of sheetrock in the garage, and hundreds of pictures fell out of this hole, and upon removing the panel, they found, you know, all of these photographs. And there were so many photographs, in fact, that the LAPD has released a collage of the various women, obviously with, you know, the explicit parts either blacked out or cropped out of the picture in an effort to try and identify these women. On May 5th of 2016, Franklin was convicted of 10 counts murder and 1 count of attempted murder. Eventually, he would be sentenced to death for these crimes. To the best of my knowledge, Franklin has never admitted guilt to any of the crimes for which he was convicted. Although, as I talked about a few moments ago, his friends who knew him during much of the time period when these crimes were going on have gone on the record and stated that, you know, over the years they saw a lot of things that at the time they just took in stride, but upon further reflection were extremely suspicious and led them to eventually believe that yes, he was the man who had committed these crimes. On March 28th, 2020, Lonnie David Franklin Jr. was found dead in his cell at the San Quentin State Prison at the age of 67. Although an autopsy is currently pending, no cause of death has been given, and according to official reports, there is no sign of assault or any other type of... But just looking at all of this, it really makes you wonder, or at least it does with me, whether or not Franklin actually committed many more murders than the ones that we know about. There's one from 1984 that the police highly suspect he is responsible for. But beyond that, there are no others that they have come out and said, you know, we think he did this, or we know he did these ones. And again, you can still go to their website and find the pictures of the unidentified women that were found to be in his possession. They also found women's jewelry and other such trinkets in his possession that could not be linked to any of the known victims, which goes a long way towards stating that there probably are many other young women who fell victim to him that we just don't know about. So that is the Death Cast for this week. Again, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as I ascended into the depths of human depravity. Again, if you like the show, please leave a 5-star review wherever it is that you find it. You can find me on social media. Just search for Author Totten on your favorite sites. If you're interested in finding any of my books, just go to Amazon and type in Ian Totten. If you'd like to join the mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. While you're there, please don't forget to click on the donate button. Every little bit does help towards the production of the show. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Till next time, stay morbid.
Deathcast.